So, this has been a very interesting conversation. It reminds me of when I first met Srila Prabhupada. I mean, he was really the first, almost my first association with devotees. I mean, he was there. I was a psychology major at Brandeis University near Boston. And Srila Prabhupada and the devotees were invited, actually by one of the professors in the psychology department. And so my first talk with any devotee was at that program afterwards. And then I gave them a ride, because they didn't have any cars back then. And one of the first things that I gradually came to understand by the association of the devotees, and Srila Prabhupada, he was there for about 10 days when I first came, was the difference between speculation and reality. In the university, there was a tremendous amount of what I would term speculation going on. And it was so prevalent that I didn't even know it was speculation. And then by associating with devotees, I gradually learned to distinguish between speculation and reality or knowledge. In fact, it continued for about maybe even 6 months after I first met the devotees. Srila Prabhupada said that every week the devotees should have an istagosti and to discuss philosophical questions. And he said istagosti means to repeat the words of the spiritual master. In other words, no speculation. So, in one of the discussions, somebody said something that reminded me of, in those days they used to have records, phonograph records, and So in one record, Srila Prabhupada was singing the prayers from Brahma Samhita, and he gave the purport or explanation, just basically from his spiritual master's commentary. And in the discussion, I, you know, quite innocently or matter-of-factly said that Hare Krishna. What is your name?
Eduardo.
Oh, Eduardo. Yes, Eduardo. And how long have you been associating with devotees?
About 2 years now.
Nice. So we were discussing my experience when I first came to the Association of Devotees, of coming to distinguish between speculation and reality. So, in this discussion, you know, I quoted Srila Prabhupada, and then without thinking, I gave my interpretation of what he said, which I took for granted as true. And when I said what I said, all the devotees turned and looked at me and said, "Where did you get that?" So I said, well, then I gave my explanation of how I deduced what I said on the basis of what Srila Prabhupada had said. And they said, well, that's not what it says. That's speculation. And I think at that stage, it finally sunk in. Now, up until then, I had been exploring various spiritual or so-called spiritual courses. And, you know, one thing led me to the next, to the next, to the next, and finally came to Srila Prabhupada and the Bhagavad Gita. And I gradually came to understand that most of what I had been reading was speculation. I would say the basic speculation or artificial conception was that we could be happy in the material world. Many of the authors that I was reading were proposing techniques to, like, make you happy in the material world or make you believe that everything was all right. And one common theme in some of the authors was like living in the moment and not living in the past or living in the future. Now, I came to see this as a type of speculation because it's not practical. It's not practical. And it just struck me that if I have to cross the street, I can't just be living in the moment without thinking of the future. I have to calculate, you know, there's a car coming. Am I going to make it across the street safely before the car reaches? And so I realize it's not an absolute principle. It's not an absolute principle because it doesn't work in every situation. I mean, it's good when you're chanting, for example, to be in the moment, not to be thinking of the past or the future. But as a philosophy, it was not practical. And just the general idea that we can be happy in the material world is also not practical because there are certain realities of the material world that cannot be eradicated by a mental adjustment. And the Bhagavad Gita mentions four, which Srila Prabhupada quoted often: birth, disease, old age, and death. These are very real miseries, and they will not go away. And instead of trying to make a mental adjustment to sort of make something bad good, a friend of mine, I don't know if I should use such language in such refined company, but he said it's like putting whipped cream on stool. The reality is it's like stool. It is stool, but you put whipped cream on it to make it all like look, very nice and sweet and pretty. So these are realities, birth, disease, old age, and death, and we don't want them. And we don't have to be subjected to them. But the way to become free from them is not by, you know, some mental adjustment, but it's by becoming liberated from our embodied existence in the repetition of birth and death. And then I thought, okay, this is real. As long as we have the body, there's going to be pain. There is going to be pain. There is going to be disease. There is going to be old age, and ultimately there's going to be death, which we don't want. So the real solution is not to, you know, squirt whipped cream. The real solution is to get out of the embodied existence. Then, I understood that the body is artificial. Artificial means the soul doesn't need the body. The body is something that we get when we come into the material world and want to forget Krishna, God. It's like in, I don't know now, but in the old days they used to put prisoners in straitjackets, maybe even in what they used to call mental asylums. They used to put the patients in straitjackets so they couldn't do harm or they couldn't escape. So this body is like a straitjacket. It really limits us. And so if we become free from the body, then we become free from all the miseries associated with the body. Now, underlying that is the basic truth that we are not the body. We're the spiritual spark within the body. And when that spiritual spark or Atma leaves the body is dead. And all the different parts of the body may be there, but the body is dead. There's no sensation. So the real... So the consciousness comes from the soul. The body, when the soul leaves the body, there's no consciousness. So that means that it's the soul that is perceiving sensation through the body. Like, I'm seeing you through my eyeglasses. My eyeglasses aren't seeing you. I'm seeing you through the eyeglasses. So whatever we're sensing through our eyes, nose, ears, tongue, skin. It's really the soul, the consciousness that's sensing it. So once that soul or consciousness leaves the body, there's no sensation. So we don't really need the body to experience sensation. Generally, people are attached to the body because of the pleasure they get through the body. But they don't realize that they could have much more pleasure without the body. So, I don't know why I'm thinking of these old examples that Srila Prabhupada gave back in the early days. Maybe the audience is like we were back then, but he gave the example that if you want to have sex and you're wearing your clothes, it's no fun. You have to take your clothes off, then you can enjoy. So the body is like a dress. It's actually getting in the way of our enjoyment. So if we really want to enjoy, we have to shed this dress, and then the soul can enjoy unfettered happiness. So that's the process of spiritual realization. So now, what about the miseries of the world? The Bhagavad Gita tells us that we have to tolerate them. They're there, but we have to tolerate them. And by our consciousness, we can experience a pleasure that is not affected by the material miseries. It's really a matter of consciousness. I'll give an example. There's a whole history, but some of our devotees in Bombay, in Juhu, were arrested. There was a whole plot, but anyway, they were arrested and put in jail. And the prisoners in jail, you know, they're pretty miserable. But our devotees, and that like the sort of the leader was Sridhar Swami, Prabhupada's disciple Sridhar Swami. They were all Prabhupada's disciples because it was during that time. So they put up their pictures of Krishna and Lord Chaitanya and Srila Prabhupada, and they were having chanting and reading the Bhagavad Gita, and devotees from the temple would bring them prasad, and they would have prasad. They were having a great time. Actually, we who were not in jail, we were the ones in anxiety trying to get them out. But they were in bliss. They were having a great time chanting and talking about Krishna, telling the other prisoners about Krishna. And then when we finally got them out, all the other prisoners were so unhappy because, you know, they were having such a good time with the devotees. So that's an example of how one may apparently be in an awkward position, but by consciousness one can still be happy. So it's inevitable when we're in the body. there's going to be head pain, back pain, stomach pain, there's going to be something. But by consciousness, we can be happy, you know, by chanting Hare Krishna. And we tolerate. I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't take normal medical precautions, like Terence had his procedure, which some, you know, it's not that we don't accept medical help, but we try to keep our consciousness on Krishna. And then the other things aren't so bad. And even the good things aren't so good. Because there's, you know, like, say I lose $1,000. That's a bad thing. But if it's not so bad if I have Krishna. And if I get $1,000, that's a good thing. But that's also not so good. If I have Krishna, I mean, what's $1,000 when you have Krishna? So you become equipoised, not by like an artificial mental adjustment, like, you know, but because you have Krishna, and no one can take Krishna from you. And the other things, gains and losses of the world, they come and go. They will come and go. You can't stop them. But by being fixed by consciousness on Krishna, you're steady. You're equipoised. It's a little late, but so, Eduardo, you just came in. How long have you been associating with devotees?
About 2 years.
And do you chant regularly? What is your meditation?
Just silent meditation.
On what?
Oh, just try to empty my head or try to go to a calm place, things like that.
Hmm. Okay.
It depends on the day, depends on the situation.
Okay. That was another one I experienced. Because before I came to Srila Prabhupada, I tried a lot of different techniques, and yeah, so I for some time I was trying meditation, trying Zen, trying meditation, and the problem with that, which the devotees told me, and it was true to my experience, the problem is that you can never find a completely peaceful place. I mean, I remember when I would meditate, the phone would ring. And then I would think, should I answer it or not? And then to decide whether to answer it or not, I would think, who could it be? Who might it be? That was before caller ID or any of these new inventions. But it's the same principle. Or someone knocks on the door. It's just... So, again, it can have value as a technique, but it's not a philosophy of life. It's just something that you do. And even then, it's not very satisfactory for, I mean, it may or may not be to whatever extent, but it's not something that covers your whole existence. Whereas Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga is a philosophy and a practice that includes everything, you know, every moment of your life in every situation. And the basic principle is that everything belongs to Krishna, including us, and therefore everything should be used in Krishna's service. Nothing is bad and nothing is good. It all depends on how it's used. Like a knife. A knife is not good or bad. You know, it can be used to cut someone's throat, or it can be used to perform a surgery to save someone's life. Fire, you know, it can be used to bake a cake or to burn down a house. So every emotion is the same. You know, there's really, you know, in the absolute platform of Krishna consciousness, there's no such thing as a negative emotion. I mean, it all depends on how it's directed. Like anger. After the first, do you need something? You need a glass of water or something? So, yes, after the first Delhi Pandal, that was like a very big program of Krishna consciousness in Delhi. So one American young man approached Srila Prabhupada, and he was just so elated with Krishna consciousness, and he said that, you know, if people could become Krishna conscious, they would learn to love each other, and they would give up their anger. And Srila Prabhupada replied, anger? Is there something wrong with anger? Who told you there's something wrong with anger? And then he said that the Krishna spoke the whole Bhagavad Gita just to make Arjuna angry. Because the setting of the Bhagavad Gita is that Arjuna was expected to fight. He was a warrior. He was expected to fight and kill the enemy. But he didn't want to. So Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to convince him that he should do his duty and fight and kill the enemy. He said, no one can fight and kill unless they're angry. So he spoke the whole Bhagavad Gita to make Arjuna angry. So it's not that anger is good or bad. It's a matter of how it's used. So that is the basic principle. Nothing is rejected, but everything is used in the proper way or in the best way. So in this way, nothing is excluded. Nothing's excluded, and therefore, you know, anything and everything can and should be used in Krishna's service. So like, say like family life, there's no, in some traditions in India, you have to be celibate, you have to be a sannyasi, otherwise you're not considered eligible for further progress. But in Krishna consciousness, it's the same thing. You can be married, you can have children, everything. But the goal should be to please Krishna. Everything we do, the goal should be to please Krishna. We can work, the goal should be to please Krishna. We can eat, the goal should be to please Krishna. As long as everything is done in Krishna consciousness to please Krishna, with knowledge of what actually does please Krishna and what doesn't, then everything we do, I mean, he's certainly chanting, reading the Bhagavad Gita, worshipping the deity, certainly all of those are service to Krishna, but anything and everything can be service to Krishna if it's done in spiritual consciousness. So this is a philosophy that covers every situation. It's like in science, I don't know that much about science, but like in science they're looking for like a one theory that will explain all phenomena. You know, there are different theories, you know, quantum mechanics and relativity and all. So there, and the different theories don't, or paradigms, they don't all like fit together. So scientists are looking for one theory or paradigm that will include everything, encompass everything. They haven't found it yet. But Krishna consciousness, that it really comprehends everything, every aspect of life, every part of the universe, even beyond the universe, everything is included. So it's something that you can really immerse yourself in completely. And things that ordinarily would be considered material, like a job, they can also be spiritualized in spiritual consciousness. You know, doing the work to please Krishna, or different ways, you know, or using some of the fruits of the work to in the service of Krishna. So yeah, it's very beautiful. It's really, really absolute. Just before I met Srila Prabhupada, well, as I sort of mentioned, I was reading a lot of books and meeting a lot of teachers. And one of them described his guru in India. He had a guru in India. And he said that his guru, with every inhalation, he went into the void. And then with every exhalation, he would come into the world. And then with every inhalation, he would go into the void. And when I heard that, I was, wow, that's really something. But then when I met the devotees, they said that Srila Prabhupada, you know, that like his eyes were always moist with love for Krishna, that he was like always seeing Krishna, experiencing the presence of Krishna. And I thought, oh, this is actually higher, because in the other one there was some duality, like going into the void and coming back into the world. But with Srila Prabhupada, there's no duality at all. It's just always with Krishna. And then I thought, yes, this is really absolute. You know, we were sort of the psychedelic generation, and so in the early days, early means like within the first, say, 2 weeks, you know. So I had this beautiful picture of Krishna, Murli Manohar, playing his flute in the moonlight in Vrindavan. And I would chant, and that picture would start to glow. It'd become like glowing silver. But I didn't say anything about it, but I thought, wow, you know, this is really powerful. This is. And then, one day in the temple, I overheard some devotees saying that one of the other early devotees had told Srila Prabhupada that when he chanted, he saw different colors of light. And Srila Prabhupada said, don't worry, just keep chanting and they'll go away. So then I realized that these things, like, you know, the picture starting to glow and become silver, and but this wasn't the real benefit of chanting. That is something that happens, but if you keep chanting, it'll go away, and then you can like get the real benefit, which is Krishna. So, any. Questions or comments? Other questions or comments? Yes.
Just a quick comment. I read something that Srila Prabhupada said about chanting and the benefits of it, and how in, you can just chant all day if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with silent meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You have the benefit of being able to go and, you know, like even when I'm at work or something, I don't have to have my bead bag necessarily, but I can just silently chant Hare Krishna. And that's one of the other benefits, I think, to chanting, to using that, and the fact that it's such a wonderful, purifying kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
When we become more spiritually purified, it just helps us in so many ways that, that we don't know at the time, like you're saying about the psychedelic experiences and things like that. And I've had that kind of, I've seen colors before from doing the silent meditation, et cetera, all these things. But that never really led me to anything higher or greater. But when I found this group, and I've known about the Hare Krishna since the 70s. You know, I used to see them parodied in movies. And I'd see them on the streets, and I always thought they were really kind of, they were very nice, you know. But anyway. Not to get into my life story. It does have the benefit of you can just take that with you everywhere you go. That's great.
I remember one of the things I used to do was like some sort of, like, maybe it was yoga, some sort of exercise or process to like consciously relax all the muscles in the body. And then the first night I slept at the temple, it wasn't even planned, but as I mentioned, the devotees didn't have a car, and I did. So I would take them on programs. One program went very late, and, you know, they just said, well, why don't you just spend the night in the temple? And temple means it was a storefront. And, you know, the storefront was the temple. And then at the back of it, there was a kitchen. And then the basement was the ashram. And they got a used bathtub from somewhere and hooked it up to a hose. And that was like, and then they put up some sort of curtain around it. That was like the bathroom. So it was very basic. But anyway, yeah. So I spent the night, and when I woke up, I wasn't even thinking about it, but when I woke up, every single muscle in my body was completely relaxed. And I thought, oh my God, I've been like trying in vain to achieve that state. And just spending one night in the temple, every muscle was relaxed. Yes, Donna?
Yes, when I was in court, I used to do what we call a chanting class. But I would chant, chanting the vows. And so when I would chant with my students, it was just such joy. It was just very uplifting of bring this up by chanting. So when we're singing to God or chanting the holy words, this has a way of elevating all of us. So it's very powerful.
True.
And that's why even telling you like you're chanting like
Yes, that's nice. Yes, Terrence.
I've been meditating for years, and I do different techniques. So I enjoy chanting, but also I enjoy silent meditation also.
Mm-hmm.
And the recent experience I had in the hospital was like late at night, because I was in this ward where just everybody was a heart patient. In fact, it's like a little city, and they would say like code blue and code green, and like code blue, I think, means somebody's dying or something, right? So I didn't want to hear all that. So I would chant, and it might be like 12, 1, 2 in the morning, and a silence would envelop me. And in this silence, it would be very peaceful. I don't know if it lasted a minute, 2 minutes, 10 minutes, or whatever. Then I'd come out, and then I would chant again. But and I'm saying a lot of different things. It might be time rambling, but daily I usually chant in the morning or something like that. But the benefit to me comes in the evening or afternoon when you just have this inner peace and you can feel it behind your eyelids. I don't know if that's not making sense. But it's all over your body, you know. But it's from chanting early in the morning. So if I don't chant in the morning or meditate, then I don't have this feeling. You know, it's like this empty feeling. I don't know if anybody else can relate.
Yeah.
And the four different things you were talking about, I said Buddhism, and that's like the Buddha said life is suffering, and it's the same thing, birth, death, old age, and disease.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you said, right?
Yes.
And that's like the four tenets of Buddhism right there, and that's why the Buddha was practicing, you know, was doing enlightenment. You know, that's why he's striving for enlightenment. So I think that just from I'm kind of a rebel. But anyway, I was just thinking, like, a lot of times we look for things to be different. We look for what's different about some things. And when a lot of religions or a lot of spiritual practices are really alike, you know, in certain ways. You know, they're more alike. And if we, you know, that's just my comment.
Well, that's good. I mean, our philosophy is a Chintyavada Vedtattva, which means simultaneously inconceivably one and different. Now, when it comes to the material world, our philosophy and Buddha's philosophy are the same. But the difference is that Buddhism has no clear conception of the eternal soul. Now, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, Buddha himself is an incarnation of Krishna. So there's a reason for the differences. Historically, there's a reason for the differences, which is that when Buddha appeared, the followers of Vedic scriptures were using the excuse that the Vedas prescribe animal sacrifice to kill innocent animals and eat the flesh, which is not the real idea behind Vedic sacrifices at all. But that's a whole other topic. So Buddha, out of compassion for the innocent animals that were being killed and eaten, and out of compassion for the people who were killing them and would have to suffer the karmic reactions, he taught the principle of ahimsa, or nonviolence. And he said, if the Vedas say that you can kill animals, then don't follow the Vedas. No. Follow me. But that was just for that situation. But there's no conception of God in Buddhism. So that's why, yes, when it comes to the material world, we're in complete agreement. But there's no conception of the eternal soul, and no conception of God in Buddhism. Generally, I mean, there are always, you know, intricacies. But Buddha advised his followers to meditate. But of course, there are like so many branches of Buddhism now. But he said, but it's hard to meditate on the void in the beginning. So in the beginning, you can meditate on me. But because he was an incarnation of Krishna, he tricked them into meditating on Krishna. Anyway, then Shankaracharya came. Have you ever heard of Shankaracharya? So the followers of Buddha were non-theistic. It's not, he didn't really speak about God. He didn't say there is God or there is no God. He just didn't speak about God. So when it comes to the material world, we're in agreement. Being rebellious is not bad, but it's a question of where to place it. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, amongst sort of fanatical people, they do tend to emphasize the differences. Like, you know, we're right and everyone else is wrong, and that's not true. You know, it is harmful. It is harmful to have that mentality. Any other comments or questions?
Well, I want to say that I think I got my question answered.
Well, good.
Instead of sensing through the soul.
Yes.
And I think that helps, so thank you very much.
Yes.
Also, one thing about this movement that I've been in movements also. I mean, heavy. And
And I was in a Buddhist group for a real strong Gurdjieff movement for 8 years, and then I followed the Kabbalah movement for 15 years. And the one thing that has been missing for me, you know, has been something that I found here. And it is the joy, and it is the heart, and it is the love, and the different level of connection from the heart to Krishna, to God. I have not experienced that in any other movement. Do a lot of, you know, education, philosophy, practice, all kinds of things, and there are way a lot of similarities. We really are more similar than we really are different. But the joy, the inner sanctum of the soul and the connection to Krishna is like nothing I've ever experienced. And there's just a happiness, you know, that comes over you. So that is something that is different here, that is infectious.
Well, thank you, Nanette. That was a very good observation. It was a very good observation. You really went to the heart of it. Yeah, I had an experience. Well, anyway. But that's the thing, the joy. Because people want to be happy. It's natural. The nature of the soul is to be happy. And we can never be satisfied until we find that happiness that it does not end. This does not end. Sorry? Yes. Yes. That's it. You're very profound, and I'm seeing that. That's exactly right. To try to love everyone won't work. But if we love God, then that love will include everyone. If we try to love everyone separately, it won't work. It's like once Prabhupada had a disciple, and she asked him, when we chant, should we think of the welfare of everyone? And Srila Prabhupada replied, you can think of everyone. You just think of Krishna, and he will think of everyone. Yes, Ravi.
Maharaj, a lot of times I've seen people having very strong experiences, very profound experiences with the kirtan, when they feel stuff coming, or you know, when they're fairly new to actually participating in kirtan and dancing in kirtan. Mm-hmm. But on japa, it's a more progressive realization. It takes time. So, but on the absolute platform, japa and kirtan are the same. Actually chanting the holy name. So my question is that there must be somewhere in the scripture that collective chanting is more beneficial to us, or is it japa? I mean,
no, kirtan certainly has a special potency to evoke spiritual feelings. But that collective chanting requires other people. Whereas japa can be done individually. And therefore it doesn't require getting together with other people. But if we can get together and have kirtan, that's very good. That's very good. It's the best. Yeah, I mean, by Krishna consciousness, you're connected with Krishna, and Krishna's everywhere, at all times. So whatever's happening externally, you can be connected with Krishna, or meant to be connected with Krishna, and that's our, you know, stability, that's our sacred space, that's our happiness.
I want to say one last thing, is that I'm really very, very, very grateful, and I realize, I feel like I've been given a second life, opportunity in life. I'm very humble because I wanted to be healed, but I didn't really want to go into the surgeon's knife or anything. So I feel that I definitely believe in Krishna. Definitely know that there's a higher power, somebody else is in control, because I totally meant to put none of it. So I'm grateful to be here. Now, I don't mean to get emotional, but they found a friend of mine dead a couple of days ago, and he had heart problems. So I thought that could have been me. But Krishna, or whatever, felt that I was worth healing. So I'm still here. And I'm grateful to be here tonight with everybody. And I don't mean to be emotional, but I feel wonderful. I feel just, you know, because I'm still here in this dimension with everybody. And that's the beautiful thing. So, and I'm grateful for your message here tonight. Just, you know, to be here. So, I'm over that. I made it through that. So it's a beautiful thing. Life can be a beautiful thing, you know, and it's all working out. Like I said, I believe Krishna, everything is working out so fine in my life, in all levels, all places, you know, family, friends, money, all of that.
All right, but one thing, Terrence, one day you will die. So we have to prepare for that.
Sure.
Krishna gave you another chance, and we're grateful for that. And you and every one of us should prepare ourselves for the time when we leave this body, because we all will eventually. And do the best we can to make sure we end up with Krishna, you know, away from this world of suffering and birth and death and old age and disease. That will make Krishna happy and Buddha happy and Shankaracharya happy and Jesus happy. They'll all be happy. Their missions will be fulfilled. Yes, John.
So when you say prepare for death, and so you will have to continue the cycle of death and birth, are you a believer in the at the moment of death, whatever your thoughts are focused on, and that will in turn influence how you possibly be reincarnated or be liberated?
Yes, definitely. The Bhagavad Gita says, yam yam vapi smaram bhavam, that whatever state of mind you're in at the time of death will determine where you go. But it's death is like the final exam. So yeah, generally speaking, whether you pass the final exam or not determines whether you graduate or not. But there's a preparation. You know, if you read the book, if you complete the homework, you know, then it's like you'll pass the final exam.
And given your life and being a saintly person, I mean, are there examples where somebody has just led a real pious life and they get to the moment of their deathbed and boom, they have some stupid flashback of whatever it might be that's not good behavior that would completely end with that? What was their whole life lived for? I mean, if they were to go the wrong direction right at the final moment of death.
Well, one good news is that we're not alone. Krishna is in our heart. And from him comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness, according to our desires. Now, if we sincerely desire to go to Krishna, he will help. There's one story that one of Prabhupada's disciples was driving his car, and it stalled on the railway tracks, and he was fiddling with the engine, trying to get the car to move, and he saw there was a train coming, but he's just trying to get it going so he could cross. And then he saw the train was just bearing down on the car, so he thought, well, all right, this is the end. And he began to chant, and just when the train hit, he thought, what will happen to my wife? And then he became unconscious, but he lived to tell the story. So, it's possible that something like that could happen. Of course, she was also a devotee, but it wasn't ideal at the last minute to think of her. But he was given another chance, to prepare. But it is tricky, because at the time of death, it's hard to control your mind by your conscious endeavor, because everything's falling apart. All the bodily functions are falling apart. So therefore, we want our attachment to Krishna to be very deep, so that even without that sort of voluntary effort, we naturally think of Krishna. So that's our preparation.
I think I've heard that there's like a process too, where if somebody's on their deathbed, there'd be like devotees that would be with that person and that can kind of guide his thought process to keep them on track.
Oh, yes. If one is in that situation, the devotees will come and help, and they'll chant, and they'll remind the person of Krishna, and they'll put sacred objects around that will help the person's consciousness go to Krishna at the final moment. Yes.
I have also heard that there are those who also, they get enlightened here before they leave. That they master, I've heard that in other, like saints, that they are enlightened. Like Saint Teresa was, that they claim, that she was very, she was such a mystic.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's our goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's our goal.
Yogananda think of the whole nirva kalpa samadhi, where there's a conscious exit of the body, and you can be in perfect health.
Well, that's a little different mood from the mood of the devotee. It's said that devotees have all mystic powers of yogis, but they don't use them. They depend on Krishna. But it's certainly a devotee can, a devotee at that level can choose to leave his body at will. But generally, the mood of the devotee is to do whatever Krishna wants. If Krishna wants him to stay longer, he'll stay longer. If Krishna wants him to go, he'll go. He just wants to serve Krishna. All right, well, quite a stimulating discussion. Very good. So, All right, why don't we can sing the Nisringa prayers, and you can get the prasad ready. This takes about, well, we're not counting, but 5 minutes.